For the World's podcast and the following message come from LegalZoom. Running a small business is a lot of work. It takes time and money, and you want all the time and money you have to go towards growing your business. But what happens when legal hurdles pop up along the way? LegalZoom is there to help. Get advice for running your business from vetted independent attorneys and tax professionals available in all 50 states. The best part is you won't get charged by the hour since LegalZoom isn't a law firm. Check out LegalZoom's business legal plan at LegalZoom.com now and get special savings when you enter the word world at checkout. LegalZoom, where life meets legal. LegalZoom.com.
Toxic recycling today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Recycling computers and phones sounds like a good idea, but it's not always the good deed you might imagine.
The recycling at places like this, people are hunched over vats of hot metallic sludge, bathing in black smoke, exposing themselves to really toxic stuff.
Plus, a same-sex couple has two kids. One gets U.S. citizenship, the other does not.
I do not understand why the government feels the need to actually spend time, energy, resources, money appealing something that is so legally straightforward.
And an Egyptian street artist tells it like it is.
Art is an absolutely legitimate way to overcome authoritarianism.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. At the entrance to our newsroom, we put out a box where you can toss your electronic waste for recycling. Broken phones, old computers, a vintage fax machine found its way in there. Perhaps you do the same thing with your old electronics. Makes us feel we're not just throwing it all in a landfill. But maybe we're just feeding another problem, and that's where we start today on the show. The World's Patrick Nguyen is in Bangkok, and he says all this e-waste is a huge moneymaker for organized crime in his part of the world.
So this is actually in the top five most profitable enterprises when it comes to organized crime in Asia. I'm talking about old computers, TVs, phones, anything with a circuit board.
Right.
And that can actually end up in the hands of shady brokers in Asia.
So what you're saying is if I throw away a computer or anything with a circuit board, it could become a revenue stream for organized crime. That's kind of depressing. How much money are we actually talking about?
So they're believed to make around $4 billion a year off this junk. And to put that into perspective, El Chapo's cartel in Mexico, in its heyday, their estimates showing that they made not quite that much. And they were moving drugs, you know, not your old Toshiba laptop with the broken keyboard.
So organized crime isn't just reselling old computers. I mean, how are they getting so rich off our electronic junk?
Well, that is a question that I spent months pursuing here in Thailand, and here's what I found out. I'm in a van, bouncing down some very dusty back roads in Thailand. We're following a tip, me and my co-producer, named Nat. And the tip is, go to these GPS coordinates, halfway between Bangkok and the Cambodian border, and you will find an illegal scrapyard, that is, recycling old electronics. And there it is. In the middle of nowhere, this sprawling factory, surrounded by imposing steel gates, with an ugly metal smokestack shooting way into the sky. We hop out of the van, tape rolling. And we are stopped, at the gates, by a woman who is cradling an orange cat, and I notice she's feeding it bits of Oreos by hand.
Sawadee cat.
It seems these two are guarding the place. Whoever you are, she says, you are not coming in here. Boss's orders. We've got police trouble, she says. We got raided, had to shut down temporarily. This woman, she says she is a liaison between the bosses and the workers here. And for someone with police trouble, she is way too candid. She won't let us just roam around, but she does explain how things work around here. Shipping containers are trucked in from the ports, she says, full of old electronics from overseas. It all gets drilled open and pulled apart, all to get at the circuit boards. And then the circuit boards are roasted over a really hot fire. Once things get all melty, workers scrape out the metal bits, like copper or gold, she says. It's really dirty work. Black smoke and ash spew into the air. She says you need a mask just to breathe. The actual work is done by migrants. 80 workers, she says, from Myanmar. Where in Myanmar, I ask? She starts rattling off the most troubled parts of the country, if not all of Asia. Rakhine, Shan State, places that are ripped apart by civil war. But look, she says, the workers here, they get $15 a day, and they're allowed to sleep inside the factory for free. We bring them in, she says, because locals, Thai people, they will not do this job. They don't want to get cancer. Now, this is the part where her boss rolls up behind her and says something in her ear. In Chinese. The boss saw you on a surveillance camera, she says. He's telling me to shut up, and you need to go. So, we go. Here's the thing. I actually already knew what was going on behind those factory gates. The group that tipped me off to this place is called the Basel Action Network. They're based in Seattle. And they put GPS trackers in old TVs, take them to recycling centers in the U.S., Australia, Germany, just to see where they end up. Sometimes they end up in places like this. So they will come here, talk their way inside, bring hidden cameras. The sounds you heard earlier from inside the factory, that is from their footage. The recycling at places like this, it looks more like medieval alchemy. People are hunched over vats of hot metallic sludge, bathing in black smoke, exposing themselves to really toxic stuff, including dioxins, which can harm the nervous system and lead to cancer. Now, to be clear, this is totally illegal, even in Thailand, in most countries actually, because there is a right way to recycle electronics, a safer way, but it costs money. You can do it the wrong way, like this, the dangerous way, and you can make money. 1 ton of circuit boards actually contains way, way more gold than a ton of gold ore. Criminals know that, and that's why these places keep popping up, even though the cops are starting to fight back. This is Thai police raiding this huge compound last year. Mountains of circuit boards everywhere. Officers charge in, workers stop dismantling computers and sit on the floor, machines get turned off. Everyone looks freaked out. The owners here, businessmen from mainland China. That is no surprise to Police Colonel Tatsapum Jaruprat. He is with Thailand's most elite environmental crimes unit. And he says, when we go to bust these places, we find that the owners are almost always from China. Here's why. Until recently, China was the world's dumping ground for electronic junk. But Beijing has said, enough. Last year, China really cracked down on importers, especially the shadier recyclers. So lots of them have fled to Thailand, a country that has good ports, cheap labor, and not the best environmental track record. The colonel says these criminals from China don't picture guys with tattoos and handguns. Picture an average-looking business person, he says. They operate differently than, say, drug traffickers, because they can't sneak around. Their crimes require big smoking factories. So I ask, if you're doing something illegal that out in the open, does that mean that local police are letting you do it, perhaps for a bribe? The colonel won't talk about that directly, but put it this way, he says. When our elite units go in for a raid, we don't tell the local cops anything.
The corruption in Thailand is very high and very serious.
Hinchom Setang is a veteran environmental campaigner in Thailand. She's pretty soft-spoken, but also pretty hard to scare. And she tells me, yes, of course, there's corruption. But it's actually worse than that. These recycling bosses from China, they may not come off as mafia types, but some are protected by local gangsters. And those guys will go after locals if they complain.
Many people, they have been threatened from the local mafia or even from the officers.
These threats, they seem to work. Riding around the farmlands near that illegal factory, the one with the woman and the cat, I find no shortage of people who are really upset about the smoke that stings their throats and ruins their fields. But when the microphone comes out, they grow stiff, like this farmer, who laughs nervously and swats the mic away.
Can I... Okay.
I meet another woman at a Buddhist temple near the factory. We're just villagers, she says. Small people. We can't speak up about this. They're rich, we're poor, that's how it goes. Pinchom, the environmental campaigner, says, look, this mafia underworld, it would shrivel up and die if rich countries, like the U.S., would just keep their electronic junk at home. In fact, there's already an agreement, the Basel Convention, that says rich nations shouldn't be dumping toxic stuff into less wealthy nations. It's been ratified by more than 180 countries, even North Korea, but not America, which throws out nearly 150,000 computers every day and doesn't do nearly enough to track where they end up. To that, Pinchom says,
American people, you have to fix your own problem. Don't dump the waste to Thailand or to other developing countries. That is very dangerous.
And just a reminder, she says, Thailand grows the rice and shrimp and fruit and a lot of the other foods that end up in American supermarkets. So rein in your waste, she says, or you might end up ingesting it one way or the other. For The World, Patrick Nguyen, Chatchang Sao Province, Thailand.
Electronics are only part of the problem when it comes to waste. Ahead on the show, an international effort to get a handle on plastic trash, and one key country that's not on board, I think you know who. Kami Rita Sherpa made it to the top of Everest this morning. I know what you're thinking. No big deal, right? I mean, the guy's a Sherpa, except it's his second time summiting Everest this week. Kami first climbed the mountain in 1994. He recently told the BBC that a lot has changed since then.
There are big differences now. I remember the ice rocks at Camp 2. In some parts, there used to be ice up to the hip, but now there's only bare stone.
Kami has climbed Everest a total of 24 times. That is a world record. And he's not quitting anytime soon, even though he's almost 50.
I can keep going until I'm 60 years old. With oxygen, it's no big deal.
Yeah, no biggie. Incidentally, remember these climbers I interviewed in April?
Oftentimes people are like, oh, you're an adrenaline junkie. And the truth is, if I'm feeling adrenaline, I've probably already screwed up.
Yeah.
It's all about the connection with the mountain.
Esteban Topomena and Corey Richards are attempting to chart a brand new course up Everest. Yesterday, Topo posted a selfie from base camp to Instagram and said they've started the final push to the summit. Or in the words of Topo, quote, the next 100 hours will be all about two brothers getting savage on a big wall. In that interview we did, I asked them what would count as success. I mean, obviously the best case scenario is to reach the summit on the new course. But what is the second best?
We just don't die. I mean, there's these three sort of tenets of climbing, which is in order, come home friends, go to the top.
I'm hoping to ask them about all three of those goals. For now, good luck, guys, on that big wall. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Elections are taking place this week in 28 countries to elect new MEPs, which stands for Members to the European Parliament. If you're not sure what that even is, you're not alone.
This year's European elections. It's a big deal, but it's not simple.
Which is why the folks at the French-based Euro News Network put out this handy explainer. And now that music is stuck in my head.
MEPs are elected to represent geographical areas. They will serve a five-year term, 2019 to 2024.
Anyway, in a nutshell, the European Parliament is a bit like Congress, but for EU member states. It approves a budget, it passes bills, and rejects them too. Getting parties from 28 countries in Europe to agree on anything is never easy. Lately, pro-EU centrist parties have had the most power in the European Parliament, but this year, far-right populist and anti-immigrant parties are gathering steam.
Un gruppo che farà un mazzo così ai burocrati di Bruxelles e Strasburgo.
Nous ne voulons plus de cette Union européenne qui fait souffler sur l'Europe les vents mauvais de la mondialisation sauvage.
Led by leaders like Italy's Matteo Salvini and France's Marine Le Pen. Meanwhile, over in the UK, no one was expecting to be voting in these elections because they were supposed to have left the EU by now. But the British Prime Minister is still struggling to get her Brexit deal approved, and so voters are casting ballots this week in the UK, and members of a new populist anti-immigrant party are taking advantage of the opportunity. The World's Orla Barry went to meet some of them.
As if Theresa May didn't have enough on her plate.
I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to set up a party. I'm going to call it the Brexit Party.
That's Nigel Farage, Britain's best-known right-wing leader and sometime friend of Donald Trump. Now, 5 weeks after its launch, the Brexit Party, according to opinion polls, is leading all other British parties in the upcoming EU elections.
We have a parliament that is now completely out of touch with our country. I think politics is broken. Our task and our mission is to change politics for good.
This is a Brexit Party event in Peterborough, in the east of England. 60% of the electorate here voted to leave the European Union in 2016. Tonight, the party is introducing its local candidates for the EU elections to a packed conference centre.
Please welcome to the stage, June Mummery.
June Mummery and fellow candidates talk a lot about the fact that they're new to all this. But anger over the failed Brexit talks has driven them to take action.
Never been involved in politics before.
Now, I'm not a professional politician. I've never earned a living from politics. I've never before stood for any kind of public office.
The candidates tell voters they're just like them. And like them, they want to take back control of their country and the waters surrounding it.
What country would give away its ocean? It's our back garden and we would like it back.
I think we should now start to use our economic power to buy British and buy non-EU.
There's also much talk about democracy and holding Theresa May's government accountable for enacting the referendum to leave the EU.
For the most anti-democratic stitch-up in recent British democratic political history. It's a disgrace.
Democracy. It doesn't just work in Britain. Look how successful it's been in the rest of the world. Look at the fantastic performance of the United States in the last 200
years. Aside from wanting Britain to leave the EU, I wonder what else the party stands for. Those attending the event don't seem too sure either. I ask one chap, Lee, who wouldn't give me his last name, what he thinks.
I've got to be honest, I've not read through any of the policies. I've looked at the website, but I didn't notice anything on it as far as any manifesto or pledges yet. So
the candidates are just as vague. Here's one of them, Sean Lever.
Well, at the moment, we're concentrating on the forthcoming elections. There will be a time and a place where we will publish our proposals for the general election, should it come.
That's right. It seems they haven't any policies except the desire to leave the EU as quickly as possible. The only way to try and figure out where the party may stand on any other issue is to go back to statements its leader, Nigel Farage, has made in the past, like this one on immigration.
The impact on schools, the changes that have happened within our communities, the fact that we have to build one new dwelling every 7 minutes just to cope with current rates of immigration.
And this on climate change.
Leading American scientists are now saying we are going into a period of between 15 and 30 years of global cooling. We may have made one of the biggest, stupidest collective mistakes in history by getting so worried about global warming. You can reverse this.
In a sense, this is a classic case of a protest vote. One single issue in one election.
And simply stick Two fingers up to the establishment.
But it's clear from tonight that this new party is thinking beyond the EU elections.
Now I'm asking you to become part of a movement that will fundamentally change British politics, a movement that not only will get us out of the European Union, but a movement that will break the current two-party system, which serves nothing but itself.
With uncertainty over Brexit, Britain's two main political parties are losing support, creating a vacuum that Nigel Farage and his party look likely to exploit beyond this European election. For The World, I'm Orla Barry, Peterborough, UK.
We got to pay tribute to an auto racing great, Niki Lauda, a three-time Formula One champion from Austria. Some of you may recognize his name from this movie.
I'm world champion, on the verge to become world champion again.
That's from the trailer for Rush, a 2013 movie directed by Ron Howard. It's about the legendary rivalry between Lauda and British Formula One ace James Hunt. This was during the mid-1970s, a time that our show editor, William Troop, remembers well. He was 11 years old at the time and living in Italy.
My brother and I were big fans of Formula One, and Niki Lauda was the lead driver for Ferrari. And this was a big deal in Italy.
A huge deal after Lauda won a world championship with Team Ferrari in 1975. William says Lauda was considered a god by Italian racing fans at that point. But then the next season, tragedy struck with a fiery crash on the track. It was during a race in Germany. William and his brother were watching.
It was like this shocking moment where, you know, one of your sporting heroes is felled. Everybody was shocked to be watching this live on television.
Lauda suffered severe burns to his head and upper body. He collapsed into a coma. Everyone expected the worst, but miraculously, he recovered.
What was even more remarkable is that just weeks later, he was racing again. Just to watch him come back, literally almost from the dead, to compete again in Formula One, it was like watching this sporting star become like a legend right before your eyes. For an 11-year-old kid, it was like unforgettable.
Despite the accident, Lauda came close to defending his title that year. His arch rival James Hunt won, but the very next year, 1977, Lauda and Ferrari won again, cementing his status as a Formula One legend. Niki Lauda died in Switzerland yesterday. He was 70. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. An American woman married an Italian woman. They had two children abroad. Now Washington says one of their sons is a U.S. citizen, but the other is not.
How do I explain to him, you are different from your brother. You're not as much mine as he is. And that's, I just don't want to. I shouldn't have to.
Their story, still to come, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. For decades, getting birthright American citizenship has gone something like this. If your parents are married and at least one is a U.S. citizen, so are you. Doesn't matter if you were born in Tennessee or Timbuktu. But in recent years, the U.S. government has been making it harder for same-sex couples to pass on their U.S. citizenship to their children born abroad. That's what happened to the married couple we'll hear from now. They spoke with us from our studios in London.
I'm Alison Blixt. I was born and raised in the U.S. and moved over to London in 2008 because I met the love of my life, Stefania.
I am Stefania Zaccari, and I was born in Italy, and I moved in the U.K. to be with Alison in 2008.
And in 2015, you had your first child, and when you tried to apply to make him a U.S. citizen, you were denied. Explain what happened.
That's right. When Lucas was born in 2015, and the end of January 2015, we expected everything to be smooth because we were, in fact, legally married. We are both on his birth certificate. We went to the embassy with all the paperwork, and they started asking us questions, unexpected questions, like who carried him? We said Stefania carried him. And whose eggs were they? And we said Stefania's eggs. And they said, and who was the donor and where is he from? So we thought, this isn't going to plan. Something is wrong here. And so in the end, they say, okay, well, because you are not his genetic or gestational mother, Allison, he does not get citizenship.
And your second child later, after that was born, I understand he was granted citizenship. What happened there?
That's right. So Stefania had Lucas in 2015, and then we wanted to have another child, and we were lucky to have Massimiliano. They were both born in London, and I gave birth to Massi. And so when we went to get his citizenship and applied for his citizenship, it was granted. We also reapplied for Lucas at the same time, thinking maybe the State Department will see the error of its ways in between the past 2 years. And so we reapplied for Lucas, and they said, you do know that he won't get citizenship, but Massi will. And I said, well, I was hoping that you will have seen the error of your ways, but I knew that we weren't going to just let it go this time, that we were going to do something about it.
And you've filed suit, correct?
Yes. We filed against the State Department January of 2018, and we've only just had last week a ruling from the judge in our case in the District of Columbia that the government's motion to dismiss has been denied, and so we will be going forward with our fight.
Stefania Zachary, what would you add to what Allison has just told us about these two different episodes you went through?
The shock the first time and again the second time, the pain in both occasions, and perhaps the second time even more, because then it was clear there that for the U.S., these two kids are treated different.
So, Stefania, let me just make sure I'm clear on this, and for people just tuning in. You're Italian. Allison is American. You have two kids. One of them is biologically related to you, Stefania. The other biologically related to Allison. That child was granted citizenship. The child that is biologically related to you, Stefania, has been denied U.S. citizenship. Correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
How much of this is coming from the Trump administration, and how many of these obstacles, these rules, were already on the books before Trump?
Well, it was already affecting us before Trump.
Right.
I mean, as much as we want to point to his administration, in fact, it was happening already. And when we filed our lawsuit, we hoped that the government would see the error of its ways, at least at that point, and realize that we were serious and that they would change the policy. In conversations, it seemed like they were going to try and change the policy, but I have a feeling it got up higher the chain and they decided not to. And then they've also decided to appeal. Two guys have also filed suit in California for their son, and they won their case, but now the government is actually appealing their case in the Ninth Circuit.
Right.
And I do not understand why the government feels the need to actually spend time, energy, resources, money appealing something that is so legally straightforward.
So you're living in London. How much is that a function of these laws on birthright citizenship?
So actually, the reason we moved here in the first place was because of the Defense of Marriage Act. So when we met, Stefania was living in Italy and I was living in New York, and we wanted to live in New York together, but Stefania couldn't get a visa to live there. So we had to make the difficult choice to be together, but have to move to be together. So we chose love and moved to London because of that. And then now, if we wanted to move to the U.S., I would have to apply to sponsor Lucas to get him a green card. And yes, it's a logistical possibility, but psychologically and philosophically, it's wrong.
You both seem very much at ease in the world at large. Why is it important to you that your kids become American citizens?
Well, being American is a fundamental part of my identity and part of who I am. And I feel that my children, that is a big part of their identity too. And also for Lucas to be told, you're not as much a part of Allison as Massi is just heartbreaking. And when we started this fight, he was too young to understand, but he's now at the age where he asks questions about everything. And I mean everything. So when we're doing interviews even about the case right now, I just feel like I don't want him to be exposed to it, because how do I explain to him, you are different from your brother. You're not as much mine as he is. And that's, I just don't want to. I shouldn't have to.
Yeah, so he's starting to ask questions. What are you thinking about the day that, you know, they both are actually asking questions about this and you will have to explain it to them?
Dread. Fundamentally dread. And sadness and anger.
I really hope that we don't have to get to that. And they won't have to watch us going through immigration in the U.S. All the time by going via the longest queue, that at least it's just me that has to do that rather than Lucas as well. And so I'm hoping that they all get solved and we don't get to that, so that we don't have to explain it, at least now. When they are old enough, we can proudly explain how we have fought for them.
Alison Blixt and Stefania Zachary, one of several same-sex couples whose children have been denied American birthright citizenship. Thank you both very much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Marco.
Thank you, Marco.
The Trump administration is planning to shake up control of immigration. Sources agree on the person tapped to take over, a former attorney general of Virginia by the name of Ken Cuccinelli. But it's not clear yet exactly what his job will be. Monica Campbell heads up the world's immigration coverage. Since we don't know much really certain yet about the job, let's just ask, who is Ken Cuccinelli? What do you know?
He's a former attorney general of Virginia. He tried to run for governor, didn't win. And he's very well known in immigration circles to be very conservative. We could think of him right in line with Stephen Miller, the senior advisor in the White House.
Not just conservative, but a hardliner. I mean, what other evidence is there to show that?
Yeah, I mean, hardliner is probably a better way to describe him. He's introduced, when he was a senator in Virginia, he introduced a number of bills. For example, he's part of this kind of the English-only club that would punish employees who don't speak English in the workplace. And what he's probably most known for is calling on Congress to amend the 14th Amendment to revoke birthright citizenship to children born to unauthorized immigrants in the country, which is extremely controversial and something that Trump has brought up a number of times.
I mean, some observers think that Cuccinelli could take immigration policy to a more hardline place. We just had a fifth child die in custody yesterday, U.S. custody. What does that mean, more hardline, though? I mean, when you think about more hardline immigration policies, Monica, what occurs to you?
There are a number of things that could still happen. We could see an expansion of the so-called Remain in Mexico policy, which keeps asylum seekers in Mexico for the duration of their immigration case in the United States. I witnessed hearings on that in Texas just a couple of weeks ago. It's a drastic change in policy, keeping asylum seekers in Mexico while they're seeking asylum in the United States. We could see an expansion of that policy. We could also see more raids, immigration raids in the U.S. targeting families. There were some reports out that that was something that Trump is pushing for. We could also see a push to even narrow the window when it comes to the ability for asylum seekers to win asylum in the United States. There's plenty more we could see when it comes to making life more difficult for people trying to enter the U.S., particularly those seeking asylum.
So what do we know about this job that Ken Cuccinelli is presumably going to take? I mean, sources have said it's an immigration czar, but we've also seen that the term czar has been dialed back today.
Yeah, we're still not sure. It appears that it's going to be a top position at the Department of Homeland Security and not within the White House. We don't know if this would be a position that would outrank, for example, the head of Customs and Border Protection or Health and Human Services. What we know is that Trump wants somebody to coordinate immigration policy across these federal agencies, and that he wants somebody who can take the hardest line possible when it comes to immigration.
The World's Monica Campbell, thank you.
You're welcome.
Earlier this hour, we told you about the growing environmental problem of electronic waste. There are similar pressures with another kind of trash, plastic. It's stuff that many of us think we're recycling, but a lot of it is dumped and burned in places far from where the plastic was used. Now, all but a handful of countries have agreed to crack down on the problem of plastic. It's part of what's known as the Basel Convention on Toxic Waste. Von Hernandez is with the Break Free from Plastic movement in Manila in the Philippines. I asked him how things are now going to change.
Basically, countries exporting plastic waste would need to get the consent of recipient countries before those shipments could be sent. So this gives effectively importing countries the right to refuse those shipments.
What led to this breakthrough agreement at this moment? Like, why now?
Well, following the decision of China to ban imports of plastic waste beginning of 2018, there has been a mad scramble for alternative destinations. In countries where there was no capacity to responsibly and manage this waste in what we would consider environmentally sound manner. The rule here is that the hazardous waste in this case is like water, following the path of least resistance. So wherever there are less regulations, that's where they will flow. What we've seen after the China ban is that most of the shipments actually went to Malaysia, Vietnam, Thailand, and more recently, Indonesia. And what we found on the ground, actually, there's very small portion of those shipments that could actually be recycled. So for the most part, it is waste dumping, these guys in the form of recycling. So it's quite scandalous because you would think that the plastic materials that you are separating responsibly as a consumer, putting in the right bin, are ending in the right places. But you will be shocked to find that they're actually being sent to these places in Southeast Asia, being dumped, openly burned, and effectively converting what used to be pristine places into contaminated dump sites, toxic sacrifice zones for the plastic waste coming from other countries.
Vaughn, I've got to ask you about the role of the United States. They're not part of this agreement. What were the U.S. arguments against being in it, and what do you lose in terms of cooperation and scale by not having the U.S. as a signatory?
Yeah, it's unfortunate. The U.S. has not been a party to the Basel Convention. So yet, as an observer, they were one of the strongest voices opposed to restricting this trade or flow of plastic waste. I suppose the U.S. wanted to keep the option of externalizing those costs in the guise of recycling. But with this amendment, it is no longer possible for the U.S. to send or export plastic waste shipments to parties to the convention unless they enter into bilateral agreements with some of these countries.
Right. I mean, 187 countries, that doesn't give the U.S. a lot of options. You think the United States is still going to be affected anyway, even though they're not a signatory?
For sure, because the U.S. is the largest exporter of plastic waste in the world. So this limits the options of the U.S. in terms of number of places where they can continue to export contaminated plastic waste.
Is the end goal here to dispose of plastic waste properly around the world or even lower the overall use of plastic?
Actually, it should be the latter, because what's happening right now is effectively a externalization of cost of waste disposal. And as you know, in developing countries, waste materials, there's massive environmental problems. So it's a crucial first step to stop the dumping of plastic waste from, especially from rich to less developed countries. Hopefully, that will spur innovation in the source countries to invest in policies like extended producer responsibility or compelling manufacturers and producers to look at alternative ways to deliver their products to the market, not using throwaway plastic, right? So really focusing on reduction. Recycling, unfortunately, will not solve this problem. Ultimately, we will have to reduce overall production of plastics.
Vaughn Hernandez is the global coordinator for the Break Free from Plastic movement. He's been speaking with us from Manila. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Protesting in Cairo with cans of spray paint. That's next on The World. Hey there, World podcast listener. We're creating a newsletter to help keep all of you up to date with everything we're doing in the World's newsroom. We want you to tell us what you think would be most interesting, most useful for you in a newsletter from The World. So I'm looking at you superfans to help us out and be a part of The World's newsletter focus group. I know you are some of the smartest listeners out there, so your input will be really important to have. Don't worry, it won't take a lot of time. Just send us an email to myworld@theworld.org and write newsletter in the subject line. That's myworld@theworld.org. And thanks. Making art in Cairo's Tahrir Square during the Arab Spring protests in 2011 was no easy feat. But a young artist using the pseudonym Ganzir was in the thick of things, stenciling political graffiti on walls, painting murals like one of a massive tank gunning down a lone cyclist. But then Egypt's revolution fizzled. In 2013, as former military leader Abdel Fattah al-Sisi prepared to take power, authorities denounced Ganzir on national television. So Ganzir fled Egypt, taking his talent for protest art with him. Now you can see his work in major museums around the globe. When Ganzir stopped by our studios the other day, I asked about the pseudonym he continues to use.
Ganzir is the chain on the bicycle that connects the pedals to the wheels.
Ganzir thinks of artists as the machines that push change forward.
We aren't necessarily the source of ideas necessarily, but by connecting ideas, we can help propel society forward, right? And that's what the chain on the bicycle does.
So if you are Ganzir, the chain on the bicycle, where is this bicycle going? Like, what's been the path from Tahrir Square to the present time? Just generally, where is this road going for you?
It's a bit of a free fall, honestly, you know? Like, there's not a lot of steering of this bicycle in any particular direction. So, I mean, I kind of see, like, the whole world going in this authoritarian, very kind of fascist almost direction. And Egypt was kind of one of the first countries that had, like, the whole occupation of squares. And at some point, there was one weekend where there were, like, 100 occupation of squares kind of style protests around the world in 2011. And Egypt was a major part of initiating that spark. And then Egypt was also one of the first to go from that to, like, the authoritarian direction.
I mean, the narrative was revolutions take time. After Tahrir Square, there was the election, Muslim Brotherhood, and then they're booted out. And now Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, former general, is in power. Is that hope that revolution takes time and we'll get there? Has that been dashed, or are you still hopeful and are your colleagues still hopeful?
There is a lot of depression in the air, I have to say. However, I am extremely hopeful because the impetus was real and the grievances were real grievances. They weren't, like, people didn't go out and protest and burn police stations because they had free time on their hands, you know? They're real, and they aren't being dealt with at all. So what's happening now is only prolonging the inevitable, in my opinion. And when it comes back, I think it'll be a lot stronger and more powerful than it was the first time. I mean, at the end of the day, all we did in 2011 was go to a public square and hold signs up with jokes on them. And that was pretty much it.
I'm speaking with the Egyptian-born street artist Ganzir. Let's talk a bit about your most recent work. You just launched a public art installation in Houston called Perpetue War. What is the idea and how did it all come about?
Perpetue War is basically a commentary on authoritarianism. So it was this public art installation under an overpass in Houston. It's right across from a piece of land where a tank factory used to exist. You see kind of these security personnel guarding on these columns, standing guard in, like, these kind of very futuristic sci-fi-esque masks with, like, lots of cameras on them, but, like, they're big smiley faces on their mask. But then we have these different artists from different backgrounds coming in and kind of painting on the guards on top of them.
So what is the message? What are we supposed to take away from this?
I think art is an absolutely legitimate way to overcome authoritarianism.
So, Ganzir, you've experienced the brutality yourself of the Egyptian authoritarian regime. You saw the violence unleashed against protesters in Tahrir Square, and now you're here in the States. Do you find parallels here with Egypt? I mean, is that stretching it too far?
Yo, when I first arrived in the States and I got on the New York subway and there was the announcement that backpacks and large containers are subject to random search by the police, that was kind of one of the big reasons Egyptians decided to revolt against the entire Egyptian state and bring down Hosni Mubarak and burn down police stations, is because excessive liberties given to the police apparatus, and that they could stop anyone they want and search them and treat anyone as a suspect. Any citizen can essentially is treated as a suspect, right? And that is kind of a really big deal. And it's something that, even though it might have been normalized in Egypt, people complained about it all the time. But to see it become so normalized to the point where people don't think it's weird at all here, to me, is a bit discerning.
I know there are a lot of political prisoners in jail. How many artists are in jail in Egypt?
Oof, it's really sad. And unfortunately, now I feel like everyone I know, I have known, is either exiled, in prison, or dead, honestly.
Yeah, so let me come back to what we were just talking about. I mean, what can art actually do in this moment when it seems like authoritarianism is just doing everything it can to eclipse voices like yours?
At the end of the day, it's a battle of opinions. If authoritarian regimes are able to get actual support for their regimes to be in power, like, the Sisi regime would not be in power if there weren't a significant number of Egyptians supportive of them being in power, right? And the way you support them being in power is by igniting fear of the alternative, saying that we are here for your security, If you go in the other direction, who knows what's going to happen? So it is a battle of opinions. So through art, you start a conversation, you propose different alternatives. And if enough people do it, I don't see any reason why we cannot actually stand a chance against the greater narrative that these authoritarian regimes can control.
Egyptian street artist and muralist Ganzir, great to meet you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
If Ganzir is good with being called the Banksy of Egypt, then Cairo musician Nada El Shazly would be thrilled to be compared to the late Ornette Coleman. Coleman, the brains behind free jazz, inspired Shazly, and now she's pushing musical boundaries, taking elements of free jazz and combining them with electronica and traditional Arabic music for a mind-blowing experience. Shazly has been creating sounds ever since she was a kid.
Growing up, I loved music, so I was playing the keyboard and the piano, and I joined the choir. I was always doing something related to music growing up, so I was seeking it all the time.
Nada El Shazly finds inspiration in a lot of places. The biggest influence right now for her, the underground music scene in Cairo.
There's a lot of music that is being made in Cairo, and there is, for instance, a huge rap scene. I'm really inspired by the content that is made in Cairo. I find it very inspiring.
If you're hearing rap and free jazz and electronica, you're right on. All of it inspires Egypt's Nada El Shazly. Her latest album is Awar. She'll be touring in the U.S. next week. That'll do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
Public Radio International.